This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Ian Wheeler and Nicholas Jabber.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks very much for being here. You're in for a great treat this afternoon. My name's Julia Wheeler, and I'm delighted to welcome someone who's really going to take us to the extremes in the next 45 minutes and give us a feel of what it's like to push yourself to the limits in travel. He's written The Timbuktu School for Nomads, Across the Sahara in the Shadow of Jihad, and he's going to share a little of the history and the mystery of Timbuktu with us. So please welcome Nick Jobber.
Thank you.
So let's start, Nick, by talking about the lure of Timbuktu and what it was that attracted you.
Yeah, well, I think it probably, for me, goes back to when I was about 6 years old. And I first, it's not a very highbrow reason, I guess, but my first sort of image that I got of the desert was Star Wars. Watching it as a child on my father's knees and just being fascinated by this faraway world of stark sand and caves and people in long gowns. And I think that got imprinted in my mind as being the ultimate faraway destination. And actually another one was watching a film, The Aristocats, the Disney movie, where the... This is a spoiler if anybody hasn't seen The Aristocats, but the butler is punished by being sent off in a crate, in a packing crate, to Timbuktu. And although it is a punishment and therefore shouldn't suggest anywhere that's particularly appealing to visit, for some reason it got fixed in my mind as this sort of the far away, the end of everywhere, which in fact it isn't at all. I mean, it's actually not that far away, but it still feels, I think, to a lot of us as somewhere that is a long way away, and people in Timbuktu will welcome you with a laugh and saying, welcome to the middle of nowhere. So there was that sense about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of our culture, isn't it? It's part of our language.
Yes,
it's like being sent to Coventry,
exactly,
being sent to Timbuktu.
Exactly,
yeah.
That sense of that's the extremes of the earth. And because it was the end of the desert, and because for so long it was very difficult for people from Europe, from the West, to get across the desert, and that's where the desert ends, really. That's where it meets the river and then onto the rest of Africa, which was unknown, really, to explorers for so long.
So that's your initial motivation. And then in terms of the book, you followed the route and followed some of the stories of Leo Africanus.
Yeah.
Tell us about your fascination with him.
Yeah. So I started my journey by going out to Fez, where I did a course in Arabic. One of the things that I always try to do when I'm traveling is to try and learn a language, learn some of the local languages, because I think it's for me, it's a way to sort of get into that culture and to try and understand, to try and think a little bit more differently from the way I'm used to thinking. And so I did that course, and then whilst I was there in Fez, it was the city that Leo Africanus came from, and he travelled from Fez to Timbuktu in an embassy with his uncle, who was an ambassador for the Sultan of Fez.
And this is, we're talking 16th century?
Yeah, this is in the early 16th century. And they went all the way through the Sahara, across the desert, all the way to Timbuktu. And the way he described Timbuktu was as this glorious city of gold plate and scepters and slaves everywhere and a very rich and a very bibliophile culture, full of books and manuscripts that are on sale in the markets, the manuscripts selling for a lot more than the value of a slave. So Leo's book, which is the description of Africa and the notable things contained therein, is...
Snappy title.
It's a snappy... Yeah, I love it. I think it's a beautiful title. And it's full of interesting things. He goes off on tangents about singing to camels, or about crocodiles, or about there's a bit where he talks about a kind of 16th century version of Viagra, a rootstock that's found in the Atlas Mountains. I think people still use it. It's a fascinating book, and its description of Fez, actually, I think, is one of the great accounts of a city. And it was fascinating being in Fez, seeing it through the eyes, not only through my own eyes of seeing it at the time, but also through the eyes of this 16th century explorer. And I just wanted to follow in his footsteps a bit. But as I travelled, I became probably as much as I was interested in Leo's story and the 16th century world that he travelled through, I was also becoming more and more interested in the nomadic communities that I visited and stayed with and in some places hung out with for quite a period of time, and sort of their story and their lives and trying to, as much as possible, to live with them, do the kind of things that they did in their daily lives.
So tell us about the route that you took then.
Yeah, so the route started in Fez, and then it went down through Morocco, down into the Atlas, into the Middle Atlas, to Marrakesh, and then down into Western Sahara. And that was quite a tricky part of the journey because it's under a military occupation, and it's very difficult to talk to people there. Part of my journey there was to try and sort of meet some of the people who were rebelling against the Moroccan occupation there. And then down into Mauritania, where I took a train journey across the Sahara into Chinguetti, into some of the great caravan towns, hung out with some of the Moorish nomads, the Beidana, who lived there, and then down further into eventually into Mali, where I met the Fulani, who are the world's largest ethnic migratory group, and the Bozo fishing people, and the Tuaregs, who are famous for their blue veils, and the Barabish Arabic-speaking camel caravaneers.
So when you got to Timbuktu,
yeah,
how much did the city differ from what you'd read about with Leo Africanus?
It's very different, because Leo's account is a beautiful account of a thriving city. So it reads almost like another 16th century account of somewhere in Europe, of Rome or Paris. And yet you get to Timbuktu and the place feels really very very desolate and very run down. Although, having said that, when I went to Timbuktu with some of the nomads who I stayed with in the desert, they would talk about it as this huge, chaotic, massive city that they get migraines from because it was so noisy. So it's all a matter of perspective, really, that to me it seemed like quite a small town, but to them it was very much a big metropolis. So I guess that maybe gives an insight into how Leo would have approached it as well.
I mean, your turn of phrase in the book is beautiful. And just to give you an idea, you describe it as the Miss Havisham of famous metropolises.
Right.
Which I thought was lovely.
Yeah, well, it's a sort of faded, it's a place of faded grandeur, I guess. And I think Timbuktu is, its identity is the fact that it's fallen on hard times, that it's no longer the great city that it was. So whereas when you go to, I don't know, to Paris, you expect it to be romantic and beautiful. You go to Timbuktu and you expect it to be a little bit run down. But at the same time, the people there have had tremendous pride in the achievements of the city and in the culture there. And one of the loveliest stories, I think, coming out of recent months, actually, so much has gone wrong in Mali, especially, and across North Africa. But there's been a project to rebuild many of the shrines and the mausoleums and some of the mosques that were damaged when there was a jihadist occupation there in 2012. And that's been funded by the EU and UNESCO and various groups. They've got together and helped local craftsmen to rebuild these shrines. And there was one of my friends out in Timbuktu, who I was talking to on the phone about it, said it felt like our identity has come back. So there's a great pride in the heritage of Timbuktu. So even though to a lot of us who visit, you know, might go to Timbuktu and feel, well, it's not as spectacular as many other cities, there is still this tremendous heritage there. And there's an excitement about being in Timbuktu. I mean, just walking in the sandy streets of Timbuktu, I'd feel a bounce in my step because I'd just say to myself, I'm in Timbuktu.
Yeah,
and it's an exciting place to be.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the people that you met along the way and the nomadic tribes and so on. I mean, you set out with the premise that there's much for us to learn from these ancient ways of life and these ancient cultures.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I think is exciting and instructive about travelling to places that are maybe a little bit different from where we are used to or where I'm used to is to learn different ways of thinking, different ways of doing things. I was fascinated by the way that some of the nomads that I travelled with, their approach to ideas about space. So when we were in the desert, I started off, to me it was sort of empty and huge and this vast empty landscape. And then slowly, whilst the nomads that I was with would teach me that actually it's crowded with stuff. You know, you look at the sand and it seems quite empty. Then you start to see that there's this sort of heart-shaped hoof prints of camels or sort of deep-fronted marks of donkeys, or you'll see a ridged wavy line and that tells you there's a snake that's gone past, or you'd see the sort of hieroglyphic footprints of birds, and you'd start to realise there's all these creatures that actually live in the desert. It's not uninhabited at all. Actually, one of the places where I really realised this was when I was sick, and I'd eaten some dry goat meat, which is definitely not advisable, but sometimes it's what's going. And I'd vomited into the sand. And when I went back past the place where I'd vomited that night with a torch, I saw about 1,000 different insects had gathered around it. And I realised that this place really is very populated indeed. So, but to the nomads that I was travelling with, they read this landscape in a different way. They read it with such sort of eloquence that they can see all these details in it, and they can see all the plants that are there, even though to me they'd often be very tiny. Whereas then when we went to the city, that was where, to them, that was unreadable. It was sort of big, vast, huge, kind of amorphous block. Whereas, you know, to me, I was more used to being able to read the details of the city. So it taught me about the different ways that you read landscape. And then the way they would see the stars, that they have a tremendous efficiency in the way that a lot of them are able to locate stars and locate a tent according to where the stars are in the sky at a particular time, and all these kind of things.
How do you mean locate a tent?
So they'd be looking at where the constellations are. They'd look at the position of the stars, and then they'd know that the tent is under that particular constellation or under that particular star.
And what's the significance of that?
Well, the significance is it's their way. It's how they're able to locate things. So it's navigation. One of the reasons that nomads travel at night a lot is because the stars are a really useful way of navigation. In the same way that people at sea navigate by the stars. It's often more when you're in the, as much as they can see a lot of details in the desert, often it's the sky, what you can see in the sky, that provides a more helpful form of location.
So we think of the term nomad as a kind of, from here, from our perspective, perhaps as a fairly homogenous group. But what did you find out about the differences between those tribes?
Well, there's huge differences, and I think it's one of the things that I learned, that I started off with the idea of nomads being a kind of blanket term, really, for people. I imagine being, my main idea really was people in the desert with camels, and then gradually, as I travelled, I met people who were in the mountains herding goats, or people who were on the rivers fishing, and they were moving around all the time, so they were living a nomadic lifestyle, or people who were in the plains, the plateaus. So one of the things in my book that I've tried to do really is to explore the different landscapes around that region where people have a nomadic lifestyle. But not only the desert, not only the sand dunes, but also the rivers, the mountains, the plains and plateaus.
I believe it's the Tuareg that you describe as uber nomads.
The uber nomads, yeah.
Why are they uber?
Yeah. Well, I think that's how a lot of them see themselves, and I think that's how they've often been described in the literature, a lot of which is the colonial literature. But there's been a tendency to place them as really being the iconic nomads of the Sahara, the blue men of the Sahara, and to see them really as being the ultimate test of nomadism, because the sand dunes are probably the hardest, the starkest landscape to try and practice nomadic life. And because politically they've been very much involved in a lot of issues that have been spreading around the region recently, and that have sort of dipped and dived across the region over the course of the last century, really. So they have this stature, really, that they're also seen by a lot of other nomadic groups as being the ones who may be a little bit harder, a little bit less approachable, but that's to do with historical and geographical reasons as much as social reasons. There's a tradition in Mali of cousinage where you have various ethnic groups are joined as cousins to others, and they're interlinked, but the one that is often seen as being more separate from that are the Tuaregs. But that's something that I think is changing in many ways anyway, as some of these traditions become more complex and as different communities are getting to know each other.
And how welcoming did you find the Tuareg? How accessible, how approachable?
The ones that I stayed with were absolutely lovely and incredibly welcoming and incredibly passionate about their lifestyle. There was a camp that I visited, and the Tuareg chief there who welcomed me into the camp, and we spent a couple of days there drinking tea, eating with him, feasted me in his tent. And he said that he was very proud of being a Tuareg and very proud of the lifestyle. And he said that he felt that to leave that lifestyle would be to stamp on the grave of his parents. It would be to insult their memory, which I thought was a lesson again in different cultures. Really, I would never think that I need to follow my parents' work pattern in order to respect them. But to him, that was very much, it was a case that you have to continue this tradition, and that is part of a sort of respect across the generations. Mm. So that was his way of perceiving things, really. But he also talked about the great difficulty of continuing this lifestyle, because they're being pushed further and further out. His tribe used to be quite close to Timbuktu, but as there's been neoliberal policies have enforced privatisation of large tracts of land, so now they've had to go further and further out to be able to find anywhere where they can actually herd their animals, and it's becoming harder for them to sustain. And then with war going on, they've had animals being rustled, they've had animals just killed or died during the fighting. So the lifestyle is constantly being imperiled. And one of the motivations for me for writing this book was to offer, I hope, kind of a passionate defence of this lifestyle, and to say this, you know, this is what it's like at the moment, the difficulties that they're facing, but also the brilliance of the lifestyle entails and the skills involved in it.
Yeah, because it's been seen as a very noble life, hasn't
yeah.
it, traditionally? And you mentioned in your book about Gaddafi, who
yeah.
would go out into the desert and pitch his tent, partly as a PR
yeah.
exercise almost, to say I'm, yeah.
Yeah, it's been exploited by politicians a lot.
Yeah.
And I think also that nobility side of it has probably been overemphasized over the practicality of it, because there's a romance that I think particularly we in the West still attribute to nomadism. But I think one of the things to remember is that a lot of the skills that nomads have, they're just practical skills about how you live with landscape. And when the apocalypse comes, which, judging by some of the news headlines, may not be that far away.
Don't say that.
It's the nomads who are going to survive. You know, they know how to live, how to keep going, how to move around. You know, you look at any apocalyptic movie, the people, the heroes, the ones who survive, are the ones who are able to keep moving around, rustle around, and
adapt.
Yeah. And nomadism is ultimately, I think, about adaptation and flexibility. And those are really the core of nomadic skill.
So historically, the nomads from the tribes that you met, they'd be travelling in that area and there would be trade routes. So tell us a little bit about what they'd be trading, what they'd be carrying on their caravans.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back over millennia, and the caravans would come through the Sahara, and when Leo Africanus was travelling, they'd be taking ostrich feathers and gold and slaves, and they'd have to pay tithes to the nomads who would be sort of toll keepers, really, who would demand certain amounts of tribute. There's a great story in Leo's book about how he gets waylaid by a Tuareg tribe in the Sahara, north of Timbuktu, who invite him and his party to come back to their camp, and they feast them, and they're incredibly generous and give them a huge feast of camel meat and ostrich meat and roasted ostrich meat and absolutely, Leo describes it as an absolutely sumptuous meal. But they also take their tax and make sure that that Leo's party pay their dues. So the nomads were able to operate this sort of slightly protection racketeering kind of lifestyle, and that did them very well for a very long time. Nowadays, it's become more complicated. Many of them have got involved in smuggling routes. There's all sorts of very dodgy things going on through routes going through North Africa, which nomads have become the masters of. But they've also got overtaken by criminal organisations, really big organised crime organisations that have overtaken and actually pushed them out of the way in a lot of respects, and have taken over arms trafficking and drug smuggling and a lot of the the darker side of the modern day Sahara, and that's in some cases you've seen nomads getting involved in that, and in some cases you've seen them really pushed out and pushed away from their own traditional lifestyles.
When you were there, were there times where you felt threatened, either with the people that you were with, or perhaps very vulnerable on your own?
There were a few dodgy moments, yeah, and it could be, you know, there was a moment when I was in a minivan, and we were driving across the Sahara from a place called Duenza up towards the river to cross to Timbuktu, and it was late at night. The journey had been going on a lot longer than I was expecting. There were about 20 of us crammed into this van, and the driver had gone off piste. We weren't on any kind of a track, and at one point people weirdly get mobile phone reception at strange moments in the desert, and the guy sitting opposite me suddenly picked up his phone, and he was talking to his parents and saying, "No, I don't know where we are, we're completely lost, the driver doesn't know anything," which made me a little bit nervous. And then we suddenly saw these guys on motorbikes spinning around us with the lights of their motorbikes flashing around, and often there are stories about people on motorbikes, often, you know, jihadists coming on motorbikes to kidnap people. So that was a moment when I suddenly felt myself sort of sinking into, oh my God, this is going to be it. I better, you know, hide my notes and wrap my turban really tight and cross my fingers. But actually, they were just a couple of local farmers who'd come to show us the way back to the track. And most of the times throughout my journey, when I was worried and I thought something was about to go wrong, it was usually actually that it ended up actually being somebody helping us. But that's the reason that I'm here and able to talk to you, and not like some people, unfortunately, stuck in some awful place in the middle of the desert.
There was a moment in your book where you're sort of dropped off in the middle of nowhere and you spend the night out in the desert. That filled me with trepidation on your part.
Yeah, but my main worry there was about things like scorpions, or, you know, is anything going to bite me in the night? I mean, I knew that I was near a place called Chinguetu, which is a beautiful old town famous for its manuscripts. And I'd been camping with some in a nomadic camp, and they dropped me off. I'd gone on a pickup truck full of goats that I was sitting on top of, and I think the goats were very happy when I disembarked. And but it was a bit too far to go to the town, so I ended up sleeping the night in the desert. But fortunately, the family that I'd been staying with had given me a boubou, a Mauritanian gown, so that was a nice little mattress to sleep on. And it wasn't too cold. Sometimes it gets really cold out in the desert. One of the tricks that some of the nomads that I met would use if it's really cold is that you'd make a fire, and then you'd sleep on the place where you'd had your fire. So you'd sort of spread the embers across, and then that would be like a hot water bottle. So that keeps you warm. So you're often thinking about really practical things like, am I warm enough? Are there any insects around that are going to bite me, or scorpions or anything like that? Are there any hyenas or something a bit bigger in the area? And often the last thing you'd be thinking about is actually jihadists, who tend to go to the more obvious places. But obviously, you're always crossing your fingers, hoping it's not going to be your turn.
Yeah. One of the things that you set out to do is something called the Salt Trail. Tell us what it is in Arabic.
Yeah, Azaleh.
Azaleh. Tell us about the history of that and how that panned out.
The Salt Trail goes back for centuries. It's described by Leo Africanus. It's described by a lot of the explorers who've travelled through the Sahara over the centuries. And it's one of those traditional ways of life that's slowly being sucked out, really. It's been overtaken a little bit by motor transport. Some of the people who do the Azaleh insist that actually, because they go by camel from Timbuktu to the salt mines in the north of Mali, to a place called Taoudeni, and there are people there who dig out the salt, and then they put it on the camels, they load up the camels, and then they ride back and walk back with the camels all the way back to Timbuktu. And it could take them over a month to do the journey there and back. A lot of motor cars now and jeeps and trucks will go and do this journey, but a lot of them end up getting stuck in the sand because there aren't any good roads out there, and so often it's the camels actually who get there and back faster and certainly cheaper. So people are still trying to continue the lifestyle, but it's been really wrecked by political events in Mali over the last couple of years, and for me that was one of the things I really wanted to do. I started off with a group of a family of Berberish nomads in north of Timbuktu who took me on what was a training for this. And the idea was I'd learn the skills needed to do the Azalea and then go with them. But then the war in Mali broke out, the mixture of the Tuareg rebellion and jihadists coming with arms out of Gaddafi's Libya, and the whole region just turned into a complete nightmare. So I wasn't able to complete it. But then I went back a couple of years later, and actually what being unable to do the Azalea did was it pushed me into meeting various different groups of nomads who I otherwise wouldn't have, so that I was able, rather than staying with one group and learning their lifestyle in a very intense and very focused way, I instead branched out and met lots of different groups of nomads, met the Bozo fishermen on the Niger River or the Fulani cattle herders in central Mali, and the various different ways of being a nomad in the area.
I guess one of the things that perhaps we in the West would perceive as being homogenous is hospitality among nomads, yeah, among Bedouin. Is that something that you found was the same throughout, or were there little...
It's very consistent because, again, it comes out of practicality that in the desert you are dependent on hospitality, so you need a code of hospitality. And it's the same in the mountains and in the plains, the plateaus, and all the different landscapes around there, that these are tough places where you need people to have a code that everybody follows so that people aren't just going to, you know, die out in the middle of nowhere. An example for me was when I was in a place called the Agua Mous Massif, which is in Morocco in the Middle Atlas, and there were rain clouds overhead. I'd gone just wandering around, really, looking for pastoral herders who I could interview and talk to about their lifestyle, and I talked to a few of them. But I realised the rain clouds were getting rather heavy. I had nowhere to stay. I wasn't sure if I'd have time to be able to walk back to the nearest town, which, because I'd been, as I often end up doing, walking for a lot longer than I'd originally planned and gone a bit further out than I'd expected. And then suddenly, this lady in a sombrero and big baggy trousers with a massive herd of sheep and goats suddenly appeared out of nowhere and told me that as a stranger in her patch, I was a blessing for her. She'd lost a couple of cows and she wanted me to help her find them. So we went off on this mad dash through the woods and over the hills, and I don't think I was very helpful, but it was fascinating watching her trying to track the cattle, because she'd look in the sort of the mulchy bits of mud where the rain had started to patter down, and I couldn't really see very much, but she had tremendously well-peeled eyes for sort of checking out all the tracks. And eventually I heard her suddenly yodel, sort of go, and then these cows appeared out of nowhere. And anyway, for my efforts, I was invited back to stay in her tent, which was amazing because it really bucketed down that night. They had a couple of dogs who weren't very happy about me staying there at all. They were not hospitable, but the family was lovely, and we stayed inside the tent, and it bucketed down with rain through the night, and not a single drop came into the tent.
So what was that tent made of?
It was made of goat skins stitched together on big poles of wood, of acacia wood. They had a little stove in the main part of the tent. It was a real hut that they'd built. So it wasn't something that they moved very often. They were sort of semi-nomadic, really. They have their wintering area and their summer area, and they sort of move just a couple of times during the course of the year. So unlike some of the more peripatetic nomads, they were able to build quite a tough and resilient structure. And they gather all sorts of bits and pieces. They'll gather bits of rock and then pieces of corrugated iron that will get sort of pushed up against some part of it as a bit of fencing. All sorts of, you know, real sort of Heath Robinson structure. Yeah. It's a
nice place. So a very welcoming code, but also quite a sort of limited, it would be good if you went now type code.
Yeah, there's a rule that you should stay 3 days and no more. And I got to a point in a camp in Mauritania where they were having the festival of Eid, and I'd stayed there, and they'd had, it was a lovely, I mean, they were really hospitable. We went into, there's a whole network of tents all together, a big campsite. One of the tents had a big dance one night, and I went into their tent, and they got me dancing with them, and the ladies, you know, putting their veils around me and pulling me towards them. It was all very interesting. Learned a few dance moves that I didn't know before. Must try and use them at some point. And it was really fun, but by about the third day I realised that maybe I needed to go, and you know, I'd really had my fill of hospitality. There's lots of different codes that you have to follow, and things usually come in threes. One of the things is tea, and there's a whole ritual about tea where you have to have three glasses of tea, and this is followed pretty much everywhere in North Africa that I've been, is that you have three glasses of tea. It said the first is is bitter like life. The second, where there's a bit more sugar added, is sweet like love. And the third is soft like the stroke of death. And if you were to leave, say, in the middle of your second glass of tea, then you would never get invited back. So you have to be absolutely, you have to stay there for all three. And it can take a very long time for the third glass to come. But you just wouldn't dream of leaving before you've had it.
Right, let's get the microphone out and see if there are questions. You stick your hands up if you've got a question. Roddy's got the microphone here. Anything that you'd like to know about maybe the practicalities, if you're thinking of going to that region, or some experience, if you've... there's a question here. If some experiences, perhaps, if you've visited.
Yeah, one very basic ask. How do you pay for this when you're staying with people? How do you reward them?
It really depends on who you're staying with, what circumstances. Sometimes I would be in situations where I had already agreed on a payment. Sometimes you would leave a bit of money with somebody. Sometimes, you know, it just depends really, case by case really. And sometimes you would pay with gifts, especially if you were staying with a family with children. So you would give them things, pens, paper, notebooks, books. Anything that hopefully might be useful. So I'd often carry around. My backpack tended to have... I always try and not saddle myself with too much luggage, but I'd often... Pens are a very easy thing to carry. On the other hand, there's a lot of ethical issues that you're constantly wrestling with about what kind of payments you give to people, or do you pay somebody just for maybe guiding you somewhere, or So you have to constantly think about it sort of on each situation. And I often just take the advice of people that I was with, because there were many situations where I would be pretty much lost in the middle of nowhere and I'd end up at somebody's house. And obviously that would entail a certain kind of payment where you might offer payment to, say, to the mother, and she would wave it away, and then the father would kind of give a little hint that he might like to have a little chat outside. And you just have to try it, and you have to try and be discreet about it, because sometimes it's also about paying people without insulting anybody. So it could be excruciating. And I think for anybody who doesn't want to offend or annoy your host who've been so generous to you, it can be a real very mind-boggling trying to negotiate that minefield. So I just try as much as possible to get it right.
Presumably you got better as you went along.
I'd also be with slightly different people who had different ways that they wanted things to be done. And some people like to be paid up front before they even, before anything happens. Some people is completely the other way around. So, you're constantly adapting to the situation. It's nomadic, really. You're having to adapt to it.
Christian here.
Hiya.
Hello.
I just have a question about your writing routine. How do you balance writing so much detail that you have in the book and maybe not sacrificing the experience of actually being there? Do you know what I mean?
So maybe about the notes that you take along the way as well.
But you want to enjoy and learn, but at the same time you're trying to scribble everything down, so...
Yeah, well, I do it by... mostly by trying to really immerse myself in the experience and writing when I have an opportunity. I would. There's a difference between, say, interviewing somebody where you're writing down their story, and sometimes I'd be using things like a recording device, in which case I don't have to make the notes at the time. And then there's a difference between when you're actually doing something. I mean, obviously, when I'm riding a camel or saddling up a camel or tracking animals, I'm not going to be taking notes because I'm going to be busy doing that thing. But it's amazing how when you're doing an activity, I find everybody's memory works differently, but I find that activities and things that I'm actually doing tend to ingrain themselves in my memory pretty precisely, so I'm able to write about them afterwards. And really just using those quiet moments. With nomadic life, there's a lot of quiet moments. You're doing activities in bursts. So I actually think it lends itself really well to writing about it, because you'll be doing these intense bursts of activity, and then you'll be sitting around the campfire, you'll be waiting for the tea to brew. You've got a long lull where you can scribble everything down and try and write down your notes, and even, try and ask the guys around you to remind you a few things that you may have forgotten or that you want to know the term for, and so on. So that's... how it works, I think.
And presumably there's a certain amount of... you don't really know what you're going to write about that until something else has happened in the journey that you might want to link it back to. And
Exactly. It's why I think a travel book is a really, it's a complicated genre. It's a complicated beast to put together. And it's not until the end of the journey, really, that I know. Even then, actually, it's not really until you've done a draft or two of the book that you start to get a sense of how the whole book is going to come together. And there's so many experiences I had which I'd write copious notes about which haven't gone into the book. And it can be heartbreaking sometimes to think, oh, you know, I went through all this and that was a really uncomfortable experience, or that was a really exciting experience and I wish I could put it into the book, but it doesn't quite fit, you know, or it's too similar to another experience. So it can be quite a complicated organic process, but I do take a lot of notes.
Okay, we've got a question there. Great.
Hi there. I'd just like to ask about your Arabic learning. Did you learn a lot before you went, and how much did you get to practice and speak when you were there?
Yeah, how good is your Arabic?
Shwe. I did a course in Fez at the beginning, but I'd also done a course in Jerusalem before that. So that had helped me already with the basics. I'd studied Farsi in Iran, so I already had the script, pretty similar to the script, say, and a lot of the vocabulary. There's a lot of crossover between Persian and Arabic vocabulary. For me, learning Arabic was one of the real big challenges of the journey, and probably the one that I felt I failed in the most. Because as much as riding a camel can be really difficult, because you've actually got to be able to communicate with a camel and hold on to a camel and learn all the different techniques of saddling it up and so on, Arabic is, if you're not a really good linguist, I think it can be it's such a struggle. But I also found it really interesting because it's such a different language from any of the European languages. It's teaching you to think in different ways, and you learn so much about the culture through learning the language. So I spent a lot of time studying it. I had a really great, I had grammar books and dictionaries and so on, but one of the best books I had was an English-Arabic Gulliver's Travels, which I picked up in a bookshop in Casablanca. And it had one page is Arabic, one page is English, and that was really good. Also, watching movies. If you're ever learning a language, I think if you can get movies where you have one language, you have the language and you also have the subtitles. I did that sort of, you know, back home before I went on the journey. I tried to do that, and that helped with the French as well.
Great, thank you. Question over here.
Yeah. When you were with the tribe, with a nomadic group, do they respect international boundaries, or do they drift from Mali to Mauritania to Algeria?
Yeah, that's a good question. One of the things about being nomadic is that you don't have to respect national boundaries, that it's in a way, I think it's even part of the identity for, if you're a Tuareg or a Barabish, that your history goes way beyond national boundaries, and national boundaries have been imposed by sedentary people to try and restrict your lifestyle. So why should you respect that, which hasn't really given you any advantage? On the other hand, sometimes laws, armies and policemen come in and make life hell for them. One of the good things, there's a lot of bad things that happen, but one of the good things, and also it's a bad thing, is something called the Nomadis phone tariff, which you can get in Mali and Algeria and various places, where you get a phone tariff that allows you to use the same tariff across various different countries. And it's called the Nomadis tariff because it's used by nomads who take their herds across borders, and a lot of these are very porous borders that they can cross. However, it's also used by some of the ne'er-do-wells in the region and can make their lives easier as well, so it can be a little bit controversial. But most of the nomads I met and talked to about boundaries and borders would, to them, you know, borders are not helping their lives, so most of them, I think, would like a much more flexible border system. And there are lots of stories of, for example, amongst the Fulani cattle herders who range right across the breadth of Africa from Cameroon through to Eritrea. And they cross some of them cross a lot of borders, and they get into all sorts of skirmishes and all sorts of problems with police and armies. And, you know, there's a lot of stories of the difficulties that they've experienced because of the lack of a system that can help them. But also, actually, even just ordinary Africans going across the borders is a nightmare. There was a guy I crossed the border with in Mauritania through to Mali, and he had his belt stolen, which he really, really loved. And he was a bit of a ladies' man, and I think he felt that he'd lost his mojo, actually, by losing his belt. So people get stuff nicked at the borders all the time.
he was somebody that you describe as a sort of modern-day nomad.
Yeah.
And there are a few people in, you know, sort of travelling salesmen and so on who've got that vibe, but, again, adapted.
Yeah, I mean, if you went for the sort of catch-all Bruce Chatwin-type definition of nomads, where anybody who's footloose is a nomad, then obviously, yeah. I think in my book I've also tried to really kind of be more, follow a bit closer to the anthropological definition, but at the same time, kind of, I'm interested in, yeah, anybody who's sort of moving around. I mean, I was moving around at the same time, so there's a certain sense of, I think when you're on the road, you know, there's a sense of camaraderie with other people who are moving around as well. And this guy, Freddie, was having a torrid time, really. He'd lived in China. He'd come over to visit his mother. He'd lost his passport.
And he was Malian.
He was from Cameroon, actually.
Cameroon.
But he was moving all over trying to get a visa. Well, that was the story that he was telling. And the story he told was that he'd been to various different places and got into all sorts of escapades. Yeah, and that's, you know, you meet a lot of people who are moving around the region for all sorts of different reasons, for work, for visas, and for whatever purpose, and have got all kinds of tales of the difficulties that they've experienced all over the place.
We've got time for a couple more questions, if there are any. Tweet, come down here, and then we'll come to you in a second.
We're talking about a vast area, obviously, but what are the politics of it as of now? I mean, is there a likelihood of a resurgence of jihadism, or how stable is it?
Yeah, it's not very stable at the moment. So jihadism is very much happening at the moment in Mali. I was talking to somebody who'd been out to Mali just a couple of days ago. We were talking about how the waves that it goes through. But at the moment, it's actually in quite a dangerous situation. There's been a lot of peace talks, but there's been a lot of difficulty getting all those different groups to come together. There's so many different factions, and there are jihadists allied to very, very big organisations, and they're really they're run like huge businesses. Some of them, I mean, the money that they're able to make. There's a guy called Mokhtar Belmokhtar who's out in. Who knows, really? But he operates in the Sahara and especially in Mali, and he's referred to as the One-Eyed, and there's a whole legend about him. And he started out as a cigarette smuggler, and then realised he could get a lot more money from kidnapping Western tourists or from taking out places like the In Amenas power station in Algeria. So these guys are working as sort of businessmen highwaymen, and they are making an absolute killing. And as long as they're able to make that kind of money, that's going to continue to... A, they're going to continue being motivated to do it, but also they're going to be able to pay off a lot of people. And in countries like Mali, which are so badly run by their own government, so badly served, people are drawn towards that because sometimes they are very desperate and their lifestyles have been wrecked by government corruption, by climate change and environmental disasters, and by... well-meaning but often incredibly foolish Western policies that have policies of Western governments. I mean, you only have to look at the way that the 2011 Libyan conflict was run by the French, British and Americans and how disastrously that was handled, which spread all these weapons across the region and turned North Africa from being a very unstable, a real kind of dynamite of a place anyway, to being one of the most dangerous places on earth.
I think we're going to have... Sorry, I will just stop you there just because we're almost out of time, but you might want to carry the conversation on after. Final question over here.
Being amongst tribes, you must find a lot of interesting folklore, like legends amongst the tribes. Any interesting you've witnessed or heard?
Yeah, there's all sorts of stories and legends they tell. I mean, to give you an example, there's lots of stories... Well, there's lots of stories about the histories of the tribes. One of my favourite stories that I heard... mainly because of the way the guys telling it enjoyed telling this story, but it was probably it was around a campfire in amongst the Fulani tribe, who I spent a while with herding their cattle with them and just sort of hanging out in their camps. And the brothers would tell a tale to scare their sister into marrying the guy that they picked out for her. And the story was that there's a hyena who can change into human form. And then there's this this Fulani girl who's picky about who she's going to marry. And she says, no, I won't have this guy because he's too tall, and this guy's too short, and this guy hasn't got a big enough herd, and so on. And then she meets this incredibly charming guy who's silky-tongued, and he's got an enormous herd, and he's very handsome. And so she says, okay, I'll have him. And she goes to his tent, and then suddenly as she arrives, she sees all these bones scattered across the floor. And she turns to the groom, and he suddenly transforms back into the hyena and says, welcome to your wedding night. And imagine hearing this story sort of at night over the campfire as they tell it, welcome to your wedding night. They really enjoy scaring her. She'd accepted the guy that they wanted her to marry. But you hear lots of stories about sort of animal tales. You know, they're very popular across Africa. But you also hear great tales of the tribes, battles against the French. There was a guy, a well-keeper in Mali near Timbuktu. He was a retired caravaneer who used to do the salt trade, and then he's in his 70s now, so he'd stopped that, and he was just looking after a well. And he told me great tales of his tribe fighting the French, and the stories always ended with them beating some, you know, a group of French guys, or seeing the French colons running off across the desert, you know, often having lost it, all their weapons or even all their clothes, and sort of running away, being chased by the tribesmen. And they were a great sort of bit of local propaganda, I suppose.
It's all in the book. You'll have to buy it if you want to hear some more. We've run out of time, I'm afraid. I would thoroughly recommend it. It's beautifully written, woven with your own experiences and insights. It's dense, it's fun, fabulous. Nick will be over at Stanford's desk there, going to be signing books. Thank you very much for some great questions. Thanks for coming. Thank you, Nick Jubber.
Thank you.